This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Thank you all very much for taking the time. Hopefully we've got a really interesting session coming up. So we'll get into it, and then Sam and Ali will have give us time for questions and discussions after they've had a little bit of a chat with us. All right, so I'll just introduce. So Samantha O'Keefe is the Therapy Dog Coordinator at Guide Dogs New South Wales and ACT. And Ali Burnham is volunteer with Guide Dogs New South Wales and AC2 in the Canine Court Companion Program. And so they're both going to give a little bit of information to us about their role and the programs they operate. And I'm not sure who's going for first, Sam or Ali?
I can jump in first if you want, Ali.
Sure. I'm happy to bounce off.
Okay, so just I guess by way of a bit of introduction, I've worked at Guide Dogs since 2000, so I'm ticking over nearly 21 years, which is incredibly frightening because that's just half my life. During that time, I started in the kennels, and then I started training the therapy dogs, and then I've moved into the therapy dog coordinator role, which I've been at for quite a few years, well over a decade. So as you may or may not be aware, the probably around, and the percentages change, but it sticks at around probably 50% of dogs go into the into a therapy dog role in Guide Dogs New South Wales, ACT anyway. So, of course, not all dogs are going to be suited to a guide dog role. And some of the reasons for them not being suited to that role are pretty benign. So it could be, in terms of a therapy dog, so it could be they're a bit dog distracted, they don't have enough drive. You know, they might be a bit too interested in greeting people, food distraction, certainly one of them. Or they might have a minor health condition too, which we try to be really strict with our health criteria. And that's probably something Ali can speak to as well, because Farah was reclassified on allergies, which is really well managed, but something that we didn't want to push her through to the guide dog stream with. So when the dogs are reclassified out of the guide dog program, they come straight to me, and then I assess them for suitability for the therapy dog program. So the therapy dog programs across guide dogs, the different states, it differs. So in New South Wales, I believe it's like the biggest one. So we place around 60 dogs a year with clients. We usually have upwards of 50 60 70. I try and cap it at 80 clients waiting for a dog at any one time. It usually takes around 12 to 18 months to receive a dog from time of application. We don't advertise the program. We just get so many people applying for dogs through word of mouth and you know, just a Google search. The dogs go to a really broad variety of people. We don't really have an age limit. It's just whether you have the capacity to manage and care for a young Labrador. Most of them are, well, actually with COVID, they've increased age where we're placing them. They're more 18 months to 2 years of age. But generally, before lockdown and COVID struck, they were usually between 14 to 18 months of age. Probably probably a good 50% of the dogs go to families who have children on the autism spectrum. And usually that's comorbid with things like sensory processing disorder or anxiety or depression. We also have a lot of adults now applying for dogs who have PTSD from various traumas. So not necessarily vets, return veterans, it could be frontline workers, police officers, it really broad range. It's just we don't have a criteria in terms of, you know, whatever your challenge might be or health condition. We just take the applications based on need. for the dog, and whether we can help too. So our dogs have limitations. They're not, we don't place them as assistance dogs. So we're pretty clear about that. We certainly have a lot of clients that go off and get further accreditation, and that's something we're certainly looking at doing. It's a really big task, and there's only at the moment two of us who run the program across the two states, and also the court program, which Ali will speak to as well. What else can I tell you? Additional training, maybe, the dogs go through. So all the dogs are at different stages of training. When we get them, we could get them fresh out of assessment for guide dog work. So they might have only been in for 3 weeks. I just placed a dog today, though, with a client who the dog's going to go and work with a psychologist who is at a very large school. And that dog actually did graduate as a guide dog, but developed something called polydipsia. So if you're not familiar with that, it's a behavioural stress response where they drink too much water and then their toileting becomes a bit unpredictable. So this dog is otherwise amazing, and he's going to be an amazing therapy dog for the school and the kids, but couldn't be placed as a guide dog because of the polydipsia. So they do get some additional training too. So we'll get them around wheelchairs, walking frames. We also get them around canes, make sure they're comfortable in built-up areas, traffic, kids, other dogs. There's a bunch of stuff we do with them. Obviously not as involved as guide dog training. It's not 5 months. It probably looks more like 4 to 8 weeks. So I think I've probably wrapped up what the therapy dog program is.
Sure.
The other part of it too is where Ali's involved is, oh, geez, it must be 3 years ago now. We've had two interruptions with COVID, unfortunately. The first 12 to 18 months started really strong, and then lockdown hit. So there was a tender, I'm trying to remember, there was a tender put out for from the Department of Justice. They piloted a court program, visiting dog program in Manly Court. Must be 3.5-4 years ago now. And it was so successful that they decided to try and get it in court permanently, or at least on a yearly rolling contract, and spread it out to more courts. So guide dogs tendered for that, and we won, I guess, the contract. And we've got the Canine Court Companion Program now, which is running in 10 courts. Soon to be 11 at Taree. Taree's been really tricky. It seems like every time we go to launch the court, something happens, like refurbishments on the court or the police station, or COVID has struck twice. And so that's where Ali comes into it. So Ali's actually been part of she's one of the originals. She's been with the Canine Court Companion Program with her dog Farah for... Oh, you started at Sutherland quite early, didn't you?
Yeah. Two and a half years ago almost. Yeah. Sure, I can just talk through my journey almost from the start, how I got involved in volunteering and how it led to the court program. So I started off as a puppy raiser volunteer through Guide Dogs. Our first girl, Nora, we raised her for 12 months from a puppy, and then she went off, did her training, and she got placed. And I believe Nora might be nearby this session, because Bronwyn is Nora's handler. So we've been lucky enough to stay in touch with Bronwyn, and we see photos of our Nora over the past couple of years. So it's been sweet staying in touch with our first puppy we raised. And then Farah was our second puppy. There was a little bit of an overlap between Nora and Farah. And Farah was a great, great puppy. And then she went in to get trained after the 12 months. And from what we understood, she was doing really well. She was in the actual guide dog training program for quite a while. But then it was a medical thing. She's quite prone to ear infections, really sensitive. At the time, we weren't too sure what triggered her ear infections. Like she was getting a couple infections a year kind of thing, like really, really frequent. Even to this day, she's still really sensitive about her ears. Even if she doesn't have an ear infection, she's very protective of her ears, and that's just kind of a knock-on effect. And so for that reason, she wasn't able to continue in the guide dog training program. So she got moved to the therapy dog program. And then when we found out that she was likely to be moved into the court program, I was very eager to volunteer, not just because I love Farah, but a lot of what I do in my work as well. I'm in the creative industries, and a lot of what we do is very socially urgent and conscious things, and just like a lot of inclusivity work is what we do. So that's kind of what drew me to wanting to be a volunteer in the first place. But then when there was the opportunity to be even more hands-on in the court volunteer program, I really wanted to jump at that. That would have been 2019, start of 2019. I'm trying to remember the years. It would have been around March.
Seems like forever ago.
I know. So we were initially signed to Sutherland Court, and it was a great atmosphere there. That all the staff were really welcoming. All the sergeants are super lovely, and were big advocates for the program. They loving having us there. We're almost there as much for the court staff and all the sheriffs and all the police, as well as the court users. And the lawyers. It was a fun atmosphere being welcomed every week by all the familiar faces that learn all the dogs' names when we come in once a week. So, yeah, what we actually do is Sutherland was a higher rotation. Maybe every now and then I was doing, I think at most twice a week, but then more people came and then it was only like once a week. It's usually once a week. And Farah, she definitely likes the busier days. There are some dogs that prefer the quieter days. They don't quite like it when the courts are super busy and it can get quite loud, while other dogs are more suited to the busy days. Farah's one of those because she's kind of everyone gets 60 seconds of my attention kind of dog. She likes to move on quite quickly. So we did the busy days at Sutherland. All we're there to do is we just walk around, we gauge who's interested in the dog, who wants to, like whoever smiles at the dog, or people are just like, oh my God, a dog. Some people will make quite a big fuss about it. We do a lot of, like, it's just Farah's job to go up, say hi. She changes the atmosphere. Even when people just notice there's a dog around, people are more aware of their own behavior. So everyone's, yeah, like it's just interesting to see how people will, I don't know, sit more formally or become more relaxed when the dog's around. We do a lot of, there's a lot of social elements to my volunteering, and that there's people will start, they're curious about the program. They ask about the program. They ask why we're there. And we're just like, oh, the dog's just here to be friendly, to distract. She's just here to say hi. And Farah, she does like a spin trick and she can shake paws and she can wave. So she's a bit performative as well. So I show people all the different tricks Farah can do. That's usually, we did that for a year. And then the first wave of COVID happened. So they shut down all the courts and Farah was unemployed for a good 12 months. And then I ended up relocating out west, so I got assigned to Burwood, changing courts, and then we got to go back at the start of this year, so we started a fresh court. Farah took to it quite well, actually. She remembered the routine, so even if she didn't, if the location was different, she kind of knew that, oh okay, we're walking up and down, we're walking around the area, around the foyer, so she picked it up pretty quick. She remembered what to do. In the same way she associates when we go out the back to talk to the staff, that's kind of more her relaxed playtime. She doesn't need to be as formal, as well behaved. When she goes out into the offices, she's allowed to kind of, yeah, that's her decompression. She plays a little bit, has a bit of fun when we go out the back. So for both courts, she remembered that going out the back means, oh cool, this is relaxed time, I'm not in work mode. Yeah. And we were there for maybe Well, until June. We did the 6 months at Burwood Court, and then we got shut down again, which is a shame.
So COVID is, you know, all the things you need to do during COVID are actually the exact opposite to the whole court program.
Yeah.
We're encouraging engagement and, you know, the touching of the dogs and the talking, to the volunteers and bending down and, yeah, it's sitting in the safe room with people and stuff. So, yeah, it was just we had to shut up shop.
Yeah.
I don't actually think we'll be back. I think it'll be a stretch if we're back before Christmas. I think it'll be next year at this rate. So, yeah, it's a real shame because it really does have a really profound impact. Even though it's quite a novel idea, you know, there's certainly a lot of people that benefit from it. It's a pretty big wave. So certainly looking forward to getting back to it. I'm sure a lot of volunteers are. And some of the dogs, they get lots of treats. I think some of the dogs are probably enjoying their sabbatical from it.
It's definitely Farrah's favourite part of the week. She really enjoys it. I was going to tell one recent, the story I remember the most from Burwood was so what I like to do is once I've gauged that everyone's comfortable with the dog in the foyer, like no one's kind of adverse or doesn't want to be touched by the dog, I do let her just kind of walk around. Like I just lean the lead over her and let her walk around herself. I was doing this one day and I would have turned my back for 2 seconds. It was just the minor lapse in attention. I turn around, oh, where's Farrah? And I see her, she's gone down one of the back doors and down a hallway where we don't usually go. She's gone exploring. So I chase after her, and she's walked in. I've just looked around the corner and there's like a conference happening. The room is full of people. It's all formal. Everyone's in chairs and Farrah's just barreled on in into the middle of it. So I'm like, oh, so I sneak in, grab a lead and just quietly take the dog back out. And then almost 30 seconds later, someone comes out of the room chasing me down and they're like, oh, you were the lady with the dog. And I'm like, yes, yes. And she's like, oh, that's actually a DV, a domestic violence, consult, a workshop, an advice session. And she's like, a couple of the women in there were asking about the dog and they're a bit nervous. So they actually want to, they're asking if they could pet and play with the dog. So I'm like, oh, okay, sure. So then went in and took the dog around the back into the conference room and it was actually really lovely. It wouldn't have happened if Farrah hadn't escaped me and run into the back room where she wasn't meant to be. It was
lovely. You might have known. Who knows? Some of these dogs are pretty intuitive.
She just saw that from the women. Yeah. And Farrah's probably at her best around teenagers, I've found. So normally she loves to just say hi to everyone and we do a few laps. But she's good around teenagers. So at court, you do come across teenagers there and, you know, they're usually quiet. They're sitting there with their parents. But that's one of the few times Farrah will actually sit down under the chairs and she's just happy to settle just at their feet for a good couple of minutes. She only really does that with teenagers. So that's always super sweet to watch her do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So does anyone have any questions about either of the programs that we do? Or I don't know if Ali's done a good job at covering off the court program, but I'm not sure if I've covered off the therapy dog program.
Both really good, Sam. So and Ali, that's fantastic. So with questions, if those that can raise their hand on Zoom probably do that. And maybe Greg and Erica, you could sort of monitor it somehow or otherwise just say your name and you can ask a question. I'll go first then. Ali, to see the court dog, Farrah, and other dogs, do they wear a uniform? So, or do you continually have to introduce why you're there?
So she does have a uniform. It's an orange vest that just sits around kind of the chest area of the dog. And in white print, it has a canine court companion program. So that's right on the top. for people to see. Down the side, it has Therapy Dog and the Guide Dogs logo. So people see the vest and they're aware that it's a working dog. Though a few times we get funny questions sometimes, like, oh, is it a sniffer dog? We get that quite frequently. Or people on the odd occasion have assumed maybe I'm sight impaired and she's my guide dog. And I'm like, no, I'm a therapy dog handler. She's a therapy dog. And it's funny. A lot of people are trained to, it's good awareness that they're like, oh, we're not meant to interact with working dogs. But then when we're at court, we almost have to do the opposite. And we're like, oh, no, this is a dog you can touch. This dog is designed for you to come and interact with. So we do have that discussion a few times around court. Yeah.
So the handlers also have a uniform on. They have a black jacket and also like a light grey polo shirt with a bit of a blue collar. And it says Therapy Dog Canine Court Companion Program. But we also, like what Ali was saying, because usually you wouldn't see a dog in a courthouse and it would be there in a working capacity in terms of probably being a sniffer dog for drugs or whatever. And so what we had to do after we launched the program was actually put sandwich boards. So we've got big sandwich boards that we pop out the front door now. I have a picture of a really friendly looking Labrador in the orange vest. And it says Canine Court Companion Program or Therapy Dogs. I can't remember what it says now. Something to the effect of, they're on site today, come and pat me. So hopefully the messaging, it's good to see that the messaging has gotten, we're well aware that not everybody abides to, you know, the social etiquette of guide dogs. But it seems to be strong enough that people do refrain from patting the dogs in the vest, without kind of being told that they're allowed to or putting signage out and stuff like that. So, it was pretty funny. We had a few registrars saying that when the dogs first started, I don't know if they were joking or not, but the story went that they'd see people running into the toilet and flushing things down the toilet because they saw the dogs. Hopefully that stopped. Yeah. But no, they have uniforms on, both the dogs and the handlers. So they're, you know, people can see that they're working.
Thank you. Thank you.
The question, if I may, Kevin, it's Greg in WA. I'm just wondering, when the dogs, both lot, the therapy dogs and the court dogs, once they've gone through their training, do they go through any sort of a accreditation process, like public access qualification or not qualifications, certification?
No, not certification. We run them through, we run them, I guess, in an informal sense through the kind of the public access test, you know, kind of the thing that you can get off the internet, really. We run them through their paces, like, you know, their hygiene, you know, toileting on cue, all of those, everything that would actually be required from a dog that has public access. We check that the dogs fit that criteria, but we don't formally do it. So they don't have assistance animal status like a guide dog would. Having said that, they kind of sit in this funny space where it's almost a bit of a grey area where they're probably, their skill set and breeding and, you know, the way they're raised and trained would sit above most of your average pet dogs. And they do get a bit of leniency in terms of access rights, but it's certainly not as much as a guide dog or an assistance animal. With the courts, though, we have permission to go in there, so they're fine with us going in there. And in terms of therapy dogs, when they're placed with clients, we do place them with a verification letter stating that they get a tag. It says they're a therapy dog, says that they've been trained, assessed and trained, and they're, I can't remember the wording of it. I wrote it. You'd think I'd remember. It's getting late. Something about their good obedience, solid temperament, good hygiene standards, and that you know, they're appropriate to be placed as a therapy dog. We have a lot of therapy dogs attend doctor's appointments, they're at OT sessions, speech therapist sessions with kids. So we have a lot of dogs actually accessing, I guess, public spaces. Yeah, but it's a bit of a grey area. It is something that we're looking at doing. It's just the resources and the time it would take to actually go through and accredit the handler with the dog. So as you'd all know, you know, the dog is definitely an important part of the team. But handlers have to be skilled too. And we have to make sure that we're putting dogs out into public spaces that are really, you know, safe to be working out there, and then not going to interfere with, you know, other working dogs. So as just being in this industry for so long, I've certainly seen an increase probably in the last, more so in the last 8 to 10 years of dogs getting accredited and coming into public spaces, which I just don't think should be there. The dogs aren't appropriate, and there's not that level of handler skill that makes it safe for either the dog or the handler. So yeah, we're pretty strict on that stuff. Sorry, that was a probably very long-winded answer.
No, I mean, it sounds like your dogs would probably pass the test anyway with the probably amount of training that they do.
Yeah, most of them would, and it just comes down to suitability of temperament and whether, because we do have some dogs that are can be quite anxious. And we would not suggest that dog goes through that kind of down that path. We'd be saying that to the client. But yeah.
Margaret had her hand up if she wants to ask a question.
I just got with the courts, when you're in the dog's court, do they actually go into the courtrooms to support, say, a witness or say a child who's in a court case having a good witness? Does dogs ever go in there to support people like that? I'm just using a child as an example. Any person?
Yeah, no. So we don't have access to the actual courtrooms themselves. So the places we're allowed to go is, we spend the majority of our time in the foyer. We're allowed access to the safe room. So that's where people go who, say, if there's a chance they might run into someone else in the foyer who, yeah, they're not safe around, they don't want to interact with. There is a safe room for people to go. So we have access to the safe room to go in there. We're allowed out the back in the offices, so where all the staff work. And that's basically it. We have good relationships, like with the magistrates. When they walk around the back, they usually joke and they're like, oh, we should get the dogs in the courtroom. Like they're constantly making those jokes. I think maybe there's been the odd naughty occasion where a dog has wandered in and it's been celebrated and everyone's like, hey, the dog's in the courtroom. But officially, no, we don't do that.
Further to that, we do get requests, direct requests from Department of Justice sometimes. I always get this acronym wrong. WDVCAS, I think it is. Have I got that right, Ali? It's Women's Domestic Violence. I can't remember what the acronym is. We have done a few remote witness sessions where we have sat with a child giving evidence. Actually, it's from Sutherland Court, Ernie, and Ernie did that. I'm remembering the dog's name. Kath and Ernie did that. There's also a few cheeky magistrates that just get the dogs to come in in the courtrooms occasionally. The reason that in itself, though, is probably you're looking at a different program. So actually, I remember one remote witness session where this was at Campbelltown Court, and it was a formal request, and we made it happen. And there was one of our volunteers, Sharon, and her dog Inky went in to assist this child that was giving evidence against their father. It was an abuse case, obviously. And oh, it was going really well, and Inky was asleep at the child's feet. And then, you know, they've got very sensitive microphones, of course, in these rooms, and Inky started snoring quite loudly. Fortunately, it didn't get caught on the microphone. But even things like that, you have to consider. You know, some of our dogs are better suited to being active and being, you know, really engaged. For those remote witness and courtroom things, you've got to have a dog that's really happy with being dead still and not interrupting the processes, because that can be really detrimental to court cases. So it would be true to say that not all of the dogs that are currently in the therapy, the court program as it is now, not all of them would actually be suitable for remote witness and courtroom proceedings. That's not to say that they're bad by any stretch. It's just a certain type of dog that you need for that. And they have been looking into it. Department of Justice have been looking into it. It's pretty big in America. Australia is just a little bit slow to take off some things, I think.
I've got another quick question. Do you also have dogs for people with diabetes?
As in like
like they can indicate when they're having a hypo or whatever it is. They can, because I've heard of the dogs who indicate for people who've got diabetes if they're going to have it. I don't know, we call it packer hyper, whatever you want to call it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, look, we don't. I certainly get phone calls about seizure alert dogs and dogs that pick up on, you know, those chemical changes that might happen in a person to, you know, indicate to them, you know, whether with a bit of a nudge or a bark for them to go and lay down and get in a safe place or something. Anecdotally, we've had dogs respond to... I've had dogs run from a child's room and wake a parent up in the middle of the night, and they've come in the child's seizuring. I've had a gentleman with a collapsed lung who the dog went and woke the client's wife from off the lounge to come in. Anecdotally, we've had this happen, but it's not something that we say that they do. We did actually consider at one point, looking into cancer detection. It didn't get off the ground, though. It's just the resources are really big. And, of course, with guide dogs too, although the therapy dog program is incredibly important and, you know, it's we want to utilise these dogs. They've had so much work put into them that just because they can't become a guide dog doesn't mean they don't have another valuable role to do. But in terms of those, you know, seizure alert dogs and, you know, cancer detection dogs, like the resources that would go into that would be huge. They're big programs in themselves. So, no, and unfortunately, again, that's something else that in Australia we just don't seem to have, that just doesn't seem to have gotten off the ground either. It's another, it seems to be big in America where they've got detection dogs like that.
I was going to say, it's Erica, whoever's written stuff in chat, I can't read that on my screen. My screen's all locked up, frozen. So whoever's written whatever they've written in chat, if you need to read it out, please do so.
And why they're unmuting themselves. I got this, Greg in WA, just talking about the justice. We've got over here in WA, I don't think it's a trial. I think it's fully working now. They've got a dog that has been trained to help people in the justice department that deal with, you know, child abuse, child pornography, those sort of things, to decompress. So the dog just basically wanders around in the office, and it's there to, you know, so people, if they need to, can use the dog to decompress their situation if they get into one. Like, you can see the value in that. Like, if you can keep people that are skilled up in those sort of horrific, you know, the sort of stuff that they see or deal with, if you can keep them in employment for longer than they normally would,
that's
got to be a benefit. And the other one is, we've just been recently looking at a report that's been done on dogs for early onset Alzheimer's. And like you say, these dogs have lots of great value, but there's no research. So once you go to a place like the NDIS or something like that to apply for
a dog that might be a therapy dog, they'll say no because there's no research to say that there's any benefits. So you're right in that, you know, they're just starting to get into the point of doing some research, and it was interesting reading that report that was done. Wasn't Deakin University, Kevin? I think it was one of the other universities, plus Seeing Eye Dogs Australia.
Oh, yeah, it started at Deakin. But then the academic moved to University of Melbourne.
Yeah, so there's gathering that evidence. An interesting report to read. And that's for, you know, helping people with early onset Alzheimer's to get back out into the community and the value that the dogs have in those sort of situations.
Yeah. Well, we do have, you know, I've placed quite a few dogs actually with people with early onset dementia and Alzheimer's and even a little bit more advanced. And, of course, one of the treatments is to get people physically moving and physically active, and that's what the dog can do. We had one dog actually for it was just devastating. This guy was a very active member of his community, was working full time. He got diagnosed, I think he was late 50s. He became very depressed. His whole world had just changed. He had to quit work and he just sat at home all day. And we placed a dog with him. He had a very, very easy block. He lived in a very quiet town. We basically taught the dog. We kind of back-chained the training with the dog. So, and, of course, he might not have remembered this, but if he said home, go home, if he got disoriented, then the dog would just kind of walk him home. And so, again, this is not something we profess to do, you know, when we're kind of advertising, for want of a better word, therapy dogs. But even something as simple as that, his wife has messaged us several times saying ever since he received the dog, you know, he started sleeping on a mattress next to the dog on the floor. He just adores this dog. He's back out in the shed tinkering. And one of the best things she said was, I haven't heard him laugh this much since he was diagnosed. So there's all these lovely changes at the end of the day, he's still going to have this condition. It's going to get worse, but it's anecdotally seems to be slowing the progression, but making life a bit better for him too. And that's where it's difficult to measure it. And I think with a lot of, you know, animal, you know, human kind of interaction, where especially with things like the NDIS, trying to prove its worth is very difficult. And sometimes too, it's the decrease in things that you need to measure. So, you know, a decrease in doctor visits, a decrease in medication, and all of these are usually pretty subtle. So it's hard to capture. It's really hard to do any kind of measurement on these things.
I've got five people with questions at the moment. I'm going to start with Kirsten Busby.
I was actually just going to read out the couple of things in the chat for you, Erica, because it was me posting.
Thank you.
No problem. So what I said was when you were talking about Farah going into that room with the DVO case, and I was just saying that maybe she knew she was needed in that particular room at that particular time. And then when you were talking about the fact how you have to say every time, oh no, you can work her, I was thinking maybe as an improvement to the uniform, they can put a big "you can pat me" sign on it.
A big handprint.
Next person with a question is the phone number that ends in 4144.
I think that is me, I think, Stuart.
Yes, it is you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. My question is this. I have two guide dogs or dog guides. One is an old 13-year-old guide dog, who's a golden retriever, and the other is a 3-year-old seeing eye dog. Is also a golden retriever, and the reason I have the seeing eye dog as opposed to another guide dog is because guide dogs don't train golden retrievers anymore. But the original guide dog, who's 13, is super keen to go out and go for a walk. And he's not up to doing what he once did as a guide dog, but he can still take me for a walk and he's still keen to go to places. But he's lost his access rights because he's been retired by a guide dog. As a guide dog. And there are so many people who know him, Charlie, and they are very keen to have him and the other dog at their premises, including a restaurant, including Hearing Australia, including physiotherapists. But technically, he's not entitled to be there. So I want to actually change him from being a guide dog to a therapy dog or whatever the word is, so that he does have rights, because at the moment...
So where do you live? Whereabouts do you live?
Woi on the Central Coast.
Oh, okay. So it seems pretty ridiculous, doesn't it, that a dog that works as your assistance dog for all those years all of a sudden loses its access rights because it's not performing the role for you that it was intended to do. It's
completely ridiculous because he is more keen.
Yeah.
Ever since I got him, and I got him secondhand because I think he must have had a bit of a tough life in his first couple of years, and I got him secondhand. And he stuck by me like glue. And he's more enthusiastic than the new dog to go out in the harness. The other day he put two harnesses on to get out. And I've been told by guide dogs, greatly, that I can't use him as a guide dog, even though I've got one of their harnesses. And yet I can't exercise unless I take him out with a harness. I just can't do it because, I'm blind.
And gotcha.
Crazy to me.
I can't really advise regarding guide dog stuff. I mean, I certainly know the processes and everything with guide dogs, but I'm not a GDMI, so I probably shouldn't say anything. When it comes to access rights,
I've got a dog now who wants to sort of assist, who people know him, they've known him. I've had him
for
10 years. And the restaurants say, well, bring him in.
And so I would say to that, then so this is what I tell therapy dog clients. If you intend on accessing or you want to take your dog to certain places, and you contact the places, and if they give you permission, then off you trot. And so this is why we have therapy dogs that do attend, specialist appointments. It's kind of, shopping centres are a bit different because they're a bit more public, but certainly, look, I would say if you've got people saying, bring your dog in, and it's a private kind of premises, then take your dog.
The advice I was seeking, I should be able to have him reclassified as a companion dog or a therapy dog or something like that, because I asked Guide Dog recently to bring him out of retirement, and they won't do it. And even though he can still take me a certain distance and get me back home safely.
All right. I don't know what their reason would be for that. It might be age. I don't know. The language around it, though, is important in terms of So you've basically got, for council registration purposes, you've got assistance animal, companion animal, and then you further down, you've got working dog, I think, and I think you've got breeding dogs and stuff like that. So anything with assistance animal, and it's not, doesn't say assistance dog, it says assistance animal. And that, of course, is in the, you know, that kind of aligns with all the, you know, legislation. With the federal legislation. So if you want a dog with absolute access rights, it needs to be recognised as an assistance animal. So therapy dog is a name of a program, and it certainly describes kind of the role that the dog has, but that doesn't exist, therapy dog doesn't exist on any kind of registration. Therapy dogs actually come under companion animal, which is kind of the same level as your pet dog. And I've actually just, I'm working with a bunch of people on a paper. I went to I'm having a bad day for acronyms. Basically, you're working on getting consistent titles for working animals across the world, so we don't have this kind of, you know, we've got emotional assistance dogs, PTSD dogs, guide dogs, hearing dogs, you know, there's all these levels of animals and access rights, and we're trying to get, you know, just these terms so they're all just internationally recognised. For you personally, I don't know if you want to somehow get a message to me about your GDMI or your O&M that you're working with, and I can have a chat with them. Maybe we can figure out why they've made that decision for the dog.
Well, I'm actually pretty ancient. I'm 75 now and I'm now retired. And, you know, my Seeing Eye dog, as I said, he's a golden retriever from Seeing Eye Dogs.
Cedar,
He's only three. But the guide dog, Harley, is 13. And, you know, most dogs would be past it by now, but he's not.
Yeah.
And so many people know him. And I just want to have him to have the legal rights to get into a place, because they said to me, well, providing he's got legal rights to be here, he's welcome.
That's probably the assistance animal only exists because there's the need of the person, if that makes sense. I'm sure it made perfect sense to you. So the dog only becomes an assistance animal when there's a need for the animal to be of assistance. So, I mean, that still makes, the dog should technically still be your assistance dog if you're utilising it in that capacity. I don't know. It's all a bit, sounds all a bit bureaucratic, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's Kevin here. Stuart, sorry, we'll have to move on.
Better cut me off, that's fine.
Yeah, no, just because it's a few other people who want to have a question.
No, that's fine. I appreciate that. Thank you for your time.
But that's
thank
good. You. Interesting.
Next thanks. Up is Geraldine, who's been waiting to ask a question, and then Francois.
Hello, just trying to unmute. no, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to refer back to the research. As a number of you will know, I did my PhD on dog guides. There is information in there. I'll put the URL into the available online. So if anyone needs to look up, there is information on some information on therapy dogs as well as comparison. So if anyone else who wants to fall asleep at night, you can always have a read.
I love a good read.
That's great, Geraldine.
Thanks for sharing that.
It was 2014 that was published. I've done a couple of papers there since too. The journals that are on, one to the International Journal of Orientation and Mobility. So you can always look that up as well, you know, just Google it. But that's the link direct to my PhD, and there is a lot of information. It's based on, it's called There's More to a Dog Guide Than Meets the Eye.
Oh.
And it's a comparison.
That's fantastic.
It looks at health from a holistic perspective, you know, a wide perspective, like looking at mental, emotional, and I talk all about, you know, the feel-good hormones, et cetera, et cetera. So there may be some information you can use for the NDIS or whatever, but, yeah, if it helps, good.
Thank you. Thank you. No, that's fantastic. I'll definitely have a look at that.
Next up is Francois and then Claudia.
Thanks very much. Fascinating, fascinating discussion. I just wanted to know, you were talking about dementia or somebody who's been placed, and I'm not sure about the level of training, but you also mentioned kids on the autism spectrum. What kind of specific training would you need to provide the dogs, and what exactly is their role with kids with autism? And the last question is just, would they be able to have that funded through NDIS, or is it purely they have to self-funded?
Right. So the first part of your question, so again, we don't claim that the dogs are task trained. So we actually state that in our information booklet and during assessment. We don't train them to task, so they're not autism dogs per se. But what we do is, and so when you apply for a therapy dog, you've got to fill out a self-assessment, a pretty reasonable application process. We do a phone assessment, and then we do a face-to-face assessment even before we consider a dog. So you have to kind of jump through a few hoops. So part of that assessment, say for a child on the spectrum or even an adult, but, you know, like I said, we've got lots of kids, we'd be looking at the level of autism and how that impacts the child. So whether they're verbal, whether they have, you know, two-hour meltdowns, are they biting, are they kicking, or are they more like, you know, kind of, are they more likely to retreat? Do they also have like the comorbid stuff like anxiety? Are they, do they have like sensory processing disorders, you know, that kind of couple with it? And then we would look at matching a dog that suits that child's needs, so they can, what we see with a lot of kids that we place dogs with is they're more engaged with their family, gives them a shared kind of activity to do, gets them out walking around. There's certainly some children that we will, or families that will go and do assessments with and say, our dogs and their skill set is not high enough. You need a dog probably with a much better, like a dedicated autism assistance dog to assist with absconding and interrupting meltdowns and things like that. Having said that, sometimes the presence of a really well-trained dog with a really solid temperament can be enough to kind of counteract those feelings within some of the kids. We issue them with like a little lead too. So if you've got a child that might abscond a lot, we make it a really novel event to kind of walk next to mum or dad with the dog, and they get to hold the lead. So they're engaged with the dog, and then they're less likely to run off. We have taught a few dogs to bridge or rest. And so some of, I guess, I don't really like the term higher functioning, but I guess some of the kids that we've had that have had, you know, what was termed higher functioning autism, where they were verbal and had some sense of self, and they could kind of do a bit of self-regulation in terms of meltdowns. We taught a few dogs to bridge, so they would lay down on the ground and the dog would put its body over their stomach to apply pressure. That's one of the pretty common, I guess, treatments of meltdowns and anxiety in kids with autism. And so, yes, not task trained, but we try and match the temperament certainly and the dog's skill set to whatever, however that child's experiencing autism. In terms of the NDIS, because we don't charge money for therapy dogs, so we do all this, you know, people give to the charity, and that money funds like guide dogs and also this program. So we don't charge clients for the dogs, but I do know that there, I have at least, I don't know, there must be 20 clients that I know of that are receiving maintenance funding for their dog from their therapy dog from the NDIS that have families with children on the spectrum. But that's not been without a pretty big fight from the parents and the coordinators. It's not easy to get. And I believe they're trying to make it even more difficult to get NDIS funding for dogs in this capacity, which is pretty disappointing, really.
Yeah, that's a whole another session.
It's probably a few.
Yeah.
Next up is Claudia.
Yeah, loved the presentation. Just wondering about the follow-up for the court companion dogs. What's the monitoring process to make sure the dogs are coping, you know, with the stress or the, you know, the program?
So a lot of that is us. It's good that we know our dogs really well. So all the volunteers are pretty in tune to, I know what Farah's, I know when she's stressed, I know when she's a little bit overloaded, when she needs a break. We're encouraged by the program that the safety of the dog always comes first. So the moment that Farah might be just a little overwhelmed, maybe it is a bit too busy one day and she's kind of looking around, I'm like, then we just step outside. And the sheriffs know that we're prioritizing the dogs first as well. So I just say to the sheriffs, oh, look, we're just going to step out for 5 minutes. And they're like, sure. And they just offer, help me go. I step outside. Farah sniffs the air, waddles around on the grass for a little bit, and I just wait to see if she's feeling good, and then we go back inside. And it's also good, the office space as well feels more like playtime than work mode for Farah. So she looks forward to heading out the back, she relaxes, she sniffs all the bins, and then we go back out into the foyer and we're concentrating and we're working and we're approaching people again. We're encouraged to always look out and make sure that Farah and all our dogs are enjoying themselves, because the moment the dog's not enjoying, you know, any stress levels, or if I've only ever had one situation where it got a bit yelly in the foyer. Someone did want to yell at the police a little bit. And Farah had a small moment of being like, oh, what's going on? But she wasn't too worried. So we just kind of, we went to the other end of the foyer and she was fine.
Thanks, Sally. Okay. We might have to wind it up now. Erica,
there's no more hands raised. So you're good.
Yeah, it's gone after nine. Or nine here in Melbourne. Sorry. Yes, it's flown. Thank you very much, Samantha and Ali. That's been really, really interesting. Really admire your work, and just I wish you had more resources to do more, to do what you really would like to do.
Me too.
Yeah, so really appreciate you coming along to this.
Thank you so much.
All right, and thanks all the members for coming in. You also make the session really vibrant and interesting. So we look forward to having another session in about another 3 months' time. So we'll keep you posted. But thanks again, Samantha and Ali.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website, www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?